Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today was born in Yorkshire in the north of England of a French mother and an English father. She studied modern and medieval language and was a teacher for 15 years, during which time she published three novels, including Chocolat in 1999, which was made into an Oscar-nominated film starring Juliette Binoche and Johnny Depp. Since then, she's written 15 more novels, two collections of short stories, and three cookbooks. Her works are now published in over 50 countries and have won a number of British and international awards. Joanne Harris, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hello.
Your story is sometimes portrayed as an overnight success. Chocolat comes out, it's followed by the film version, suddenly you're world famous, there's all of this going on. In fact,
yeah, you became... Yeah, it was a
long night. You became one of the only of four members of the Millionaires Club, and that's authors who've achieved a million sales of one book in the
yeah,
UK.
Yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer, really. A million sales in the UK, absolutely. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're an actual millionaire, though, unfortunately, but yeah. It's a very nice thing, and it was an astonishingly successful book for something that I had been told wouldn't sell.
Well, and also not overnight at all. This
no,
had been
it
hard
wasn't.
Graft
it took,
for
it
a,
took
long
a very
time.
Long time to get where I got. It was just that I was completely unnoticed until the success of this rather odd little book that nobody expected to see achieve anything, really.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of your writing career, because The Evil Seed came out and didn't really have the kind of commercial success you were hoping for.
No, I wasn't really hoping for commercial success. I was just as happy just to see it in print, actually. It was a bit of an odd book. It was a horror novel that was so literary that I don't think that horror fans really understood that it was supposed to be for them. And literary fans certainly didn't think it was supposed to be for them. And so it ended up having a cult following, as we say, which meant that it was largely unread. And it was also not entirely the style in which I was going to mature into. I was pastiching other writers at that point. And I did it with my next book too, Sleek Pale Sister. They were both gothic pastiches a la Wilkie Collins rather than my own voice. I learnt a lot from writing them, though, and I'm still very fond of them.
And at that time, were you just writing or were you still teaching?
Oh, I was still teaching. Right until Chocolat came out, I was still teaching. There would have been no way for me to give up my day job with the sort of payment that I was getting for those books, which I think came to about 2.5p an hour. I worked it out once.
And that's what it came to?
Absolutely. And that was just the writing time and not the research or any of the expenses or anything.
Well, they do say that the average earning for a novelist in this country is, what, £11,000 a year?
It's very small. And that's the average, which means that there are people who are making much less and, in fact, nothing at all. It's not a high-paid job, generally. The fact that a very few authors are highly paid doesn't make it easy for the rest of them.
Mm. And that's usually because there's a film or some kind of merchandising deal attached to it.
Yes. Often it means that there has been something else. Although not all authors make a lot of money from movies either. It depends when they're optioned and how much for.
Mm. Let's talk about your latest book, because it's called Different Class, and it's the third of a series of novels set in the fictional town of Mulberry. It follows on directly from Gentlemen and Players, revisiting St Oswald's Grammar School. But I wonder if the books stand alone. Do you have to read all three?
No, you don't have to read all three. They do stand alone. What happens is that they kind of mesh in a way that completionists may enjoy, because they will see characters returning. But the stories stand completely alone, really. I think I'm working on something which eventually, when my life's work's finished, will turn out to be a jigsaw puzzle, all the pieces of which fit beautifully together, if I live that long and if I get to write all those books. So, yeah, everything's kind of connected, but no, the story stands fine, just on its own.
Of course, it's set in a school, and we reference the fact that you were teaching. Did you enjoy your teaching job?
I loved it. It was exhausting. It was unpredictable. It was a perpetual stage for tragedy and farce. But I was good at it, and I would have stayed a teacher quite happily if events hadn't overtaken me and forced me to make a choice.
How closely does St Oswald's, is it modelled on the school in which you worked?
Well, I worked in several schools, and they all have different quirks and eccentricities. But for a long time, I worked in a place called Leeds Grammar School, which was a boys' school. And yes, it does have some things in common with St Oswald's. But then again, so does my college at Cambridge. So does the girls' school I attended as a child. It's a kind of mashup of all the institutions I've ever been in. Mm. And there are little semi-vignettes of people I may have worked with, but nothing is portraiture. Nothing is, you know, this is supposed to be a roman, a clé or anything like that.
Mm. The main protagonist couldn't be more different from you, could he?
Well, I don't know. We've got lots of things in common, you know. I think, you know, in some ways, Roy Straitley is the person I could have been if I'd spent another 30 years in teaching. I might have ended up quite a lot like him. He is older than his years. At 65, he behaves as if he's much older because he's from an earlier generation. He's quite quirky. He's quite grumpy. He doesn't like suits. He doesn't like emails. He doesn't like technology. But we do share a love of licorice all sorts and tea and a mistrust of people in offices. Mm. But it's a lot of fun doing his voice. Mm. I knew a lot of people very like him. Leeds Grammar School was mostly peopled with old men and teenage boys. And so there was a lot to work from there. And there are a lot of great characters. And he's, I have borrowed from a number of places to make Straitley. But it's a lot of fun putting his mantle on and doing his voice.
You can see that the enjoyment of it, the sheer pleasure of it comes through so much in the writing, doesn't it? The other voice, the other main voice, is a very complex character in that he's both victim and abuser. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about Ziggy and how you navigate the shades of grey between blame and sympathy.
Well, yes, it is very much about shades of grey, really. I didn't want this to be a good guy, bad guy story because none of my stories are like this. And Ziggy is a character who is at the same time toxic and deeply unhappy and in an environment which is going to cause nothing but trouble for him. I'm not entirely sure what's wrong with Ziggy, but he clearly has problems. He talks about his condition, which we are led to believe may be one thing, but turns out to be something completely different. He would like to fit in, but he doesn't. Mm. He has all kinds of inappropriate thoughts and ideas, which, of course, because this is first-person narrative, he vocalises. But really, at the heart, he is a teenage boy trying to find his way in the world. And he has done terrible things and terrible things happen to him.
You must have an amazing insight, actually, into teenage boys. It was boys that you were teaching.
Yes, it was boys. Yes, for something like 13, 14 years, I taught nothing but boys. I didn't mean to go into a single-sex school or a private school. It just happened that way. And it was an odd environment for me because it was fundamentally different to anything that I'd known. I was, you know, one of a handful of female members of staff, and I was certainly the youngest for a long time. And it made for an interesting dynamic. It meant that I had to be quite tough and I had to evolve methods of dealing, both with the boys and with members of staff, too. Mm. It was quite a bit of attempted bullying. It didn't work all that well, but they did try for a while.
I can't imagine it possibly succeeding.
Some of the boys tell me that I was very frightening and that I was basically Professor Snape. I take this to be a good thing.
Are they different from us? I look at teenage boys and think you are another species.
Yes and no. No, they just hide things in a different way. I find boys actually quite easy to deal with, having taught mixed classes. The thing about boys and the way they relate to a female teacher is that there is no jockeying for position. You know, a teenage boy may square up to a male teacher because there is a kind of instinct to do that. That doesn't quite happen in the same way with a female teacher. They used to talk to me, some of them confided in me. It was a different influence, I think. And because it was a very male, very patriarchal, very kind of aggressive surrounding where boys were addressed by their surnames and made to stand in line and treated like little soldiers, it was, I think, probably nice for them to have somebody who didn't do that and who valued different things about them. And so, you know, the ones who were interested in books and music as opposed to rugby and chapel and cold showers tended to come and talk to me.
And so, in a way, you become the Harry character in the book.
Oh, I hope not. Well, I knew somebody a bit like Harry. I knew several members of staff a little like Harry Clark, who is the English master, and he is quite young and he's quite approachable and he has records in his classroom and he rather disastrously encourages boys to call him by his first name. And all this leads to a rather unfortunate series of happenings. I think it's interesting, the dynamic between teachers and pupils. It's interesting because there's a line that needs to be maintained. Not all teachers know how to do this. You have to remember that you're not there to be a friend to the pupils and that however they may like you, they won't think of you as one of them. On the other hand, there is no reason to be mean or aloof or dismissive or scornful either. I think as a female member of staff, I had quite a lot of boys who had crushes on me. Mind you, they had crushes on male members of staff as well, because it's the kind of thing that happens when you are around teenagers. They feel things very intensely. They have intense, violent enthusiasms for things, and they do fix on people. And they get to feeling that perhaps, you know, you favour them in a way. And you've got to watch that. I think you have to watch where you step. So I was always quite careful about how close I allowed boys to get to me. And I ran clubs and but I didn't, you know, I wasn't the sort of teacher who would have encouraged boys to see me in private or to socialise with. And nowadays, of course, that happens all the time. And often you read of stories where this goes disastrously wrong. It often has done in the past. Mm.
And often victims of abuse can't or won't remember what's happened. It's just too painful for them. You write, as Ziggy, this wonderful, wonderful line, memory isn't a camera, it's an anthill, a thing of layers built around a central core. Mm. And I just wondered if you'd explore that image for us a little bit.
Well, it's interesting because as I was researching and writing the initial draft of this book, I was also judging a science prize. It was the Royal Society Prize for Science. And I got to read a lot of books that were non-fiction in areas that I hadn't explored. And there was one particular book called Pieces of Light, which was about the brain and particularly the operation of the memory. And it sparked off a whole cascade of ideas that I used in different class about how we think that the memory is a movie camera and we think that these memories are immutable. But in fact, every time we recall a memory, we're building it up in layers from scratch, and bits of our brain are firing pieces of information. And also, every time we recall the memory, it is slightly moved and shaped by whatever has happened in between and by the circumstances in which we recall it. So if it's a traumatic memory, we are often quite suggestible to introducing elements of change. And this is why, you know, when my mother tells a story about my brother, sometimes I think it happened to me and sometimes he thinks it happens to him, and we don't know anymore because we've heard it and remembered it in different ways too often. Mm. And so the idea that memory is a mutable algorithm and that we can't see it as an objective record of something that happened, that to me was a real eye-opening concept.
Absolutely, and it's one that comes up a lot again and again in this book, doesn't it?
Indeed.
As things are remembered or misremembered.
I got to thinking that actually we can't really trust what we remember, which of course puts a big question mark on the idea of eyewitness testimony. And it suggests that somebody may think that they are remembering something perfectly and actually find that they have remembered it differently or imperfectly. Mm. And that too, it's a very uncomfortable thought.
I'd like to turn now, if we can, to music, because Ziggy's nickname stems obviously from David Bowie, and there's a lot about music in the book, and particularly Bowie's music. I wondered about the timeline. Was Bowie still alive when you were writing
it? Oh, totally. It was everything. I was horrified because I mention Harper Lee and David Bowie and Barry Hines all in the first chapter of Different Class. And by the time the proofs were out, they were all dead. And I thought, what's happening? Is this something that's to watch out Jarvis Cocker, basically?
The curse of Joanne Harris.
I had no idea that was going to happen. And it became very poignant, actually. But no, Ziggy discovers, through his hero, the English master Harry, discovers David Bowie. And falls in love with that music and falls in love with a number of other albums. And he feels that they are expressing something for him. And of course they are. That's how music works.
Mm. You made me remember how it felt to first hear those albums and how it really did change the way you thought about things.
Yeah. Very much. Well, when I was a teacher, very often, because I taught the third form, and so these boys were 13, 14, and that's the time where the wild enthusiasms really kick in. And so, you know, every week some boy would come in clutching a cassette or an album and he would say, "Oh, miss, I've heard this wonderful music." And you go, "Yes, Stairway to Heaven, isn't it? Or it's Pink Floyd's The Wall." And they would be genuinely surprised that I'd heard of it. But, you know, this happened all the time.
Mm. I hear you're a great fan of stage musicals.
I do. I love musical theatre. I love progressive rock and all sorts of things. But musical theatre is something else. Mm.
Can you listen to music while you're writing?
I did with this book, strangely. Most of the time I don't. Very often I create playlists for books, but I don't listen to them when I'm actually writing. I listen to them to get into the mood. This one was obviously Pulp, Different Class. But yes, to me, music and writing, it's slightly antagonistic because I read aloud a lot when I'm writing. The music would interfere with the rhythms of what I was reading. But it's quite nice to get into a kind of headspace with music. And so, yes, I do use music for that.
Mm. Where do you write?
I mostly write in my shed. in the garden. If I'm lucky and I get ideal circumstances, that's where I go. My husband had it built when I complained that I didn't have a place of my own. And it's quite nice to have, I think, a designated workspace, somewhere where you go just to write, and which is far enough away from the house to not be a constant source of interruption.
And you don't have to interact with people necessarily. I heard a wonderful provocation that you gave where you laid out a writer's manifesto and you talked about the internet and social media blurring the lines between readers and writers. And I just wondered if writing, obviously being such a solitary career, that if social media has changed the way that you interact with your readers.
It's interesting. Well, social media has made it possible for me to interact with my readers. Before, it really wasn't possible, unless you met people face to face at a festival or in a signing queue. And that's generally not a great way to have a conversation. Then you didn't get to meet the readers. No, I love the internet for all sorts of reasons, and partly it's that it's given me the chance to talk to people from all sorts of different backgrounds about all kinds of different things. And I think it's very valuable.
It does, as you said in your provocation, that there's a perception that anyone can write. And of course, that isn't necessarily the case. Everyone has a book in them. And in some cases, that book should stay firmly there in them.
Well, I don't know. It's not quite that. It's the idea that, yes, of course, anyone can write. However, it's not necessarily the case that everybody is likely to get either an audience or interest from readers in their writing. And of course, I think the thing is, people write for all kinds of reasons. Being commercially published is only one of them. And I think with the kind of Cinderella stories that the media sometimes disseminates, it can create a false expectation in people who forget that actually there are so many other reasons to write than just getting a book deal. And they expect that because they are writing, then they will get a book deal and they're entitled to one. Well, that is sometimes setting people up for tremendous disappointment. Mm. And I like to encourage people to write, but not necessarily to assume that you know, they are going to make it to the top, or indeed whether that would suit them.
Mm. I mean, there are so many calls on a writer's time and energy. As you point out, you know, plumbers aren't asked to do plumbing for free or just for a bit of publicity.
Artists are really the only group of people who are expected to be these philanthropists giving joy to people for no pay, and whose time is effectively worthless because they enjoy what they're doing. And this is a commonly held belief which I've tried to fight because, you know, as we know, artists generally aren't paid that much. Some find it very difficult to get a living from what they do. And just because they enjoy it, it doesn't mean to say that it's not work or that it's worthless. And so, yes, I'm hoping that the attitude has started to change now and people have started to understand that, you know, this mysterious thing that we do that not even we entirely understand is still a job.
And in terms of literary festivals, I mean, that's where we're really seeing it change at the moment. Do you think then that every performer, I suppose that's the wrong word, really, that every writer who is, I don't know, giving a performance, I suppose, at a literary festival should be paid?
Yes, I think they should. I think ideally they should all be paid the same. This would make it possible, I think, for literary festivals to invite a broad spectrum of people, because actually the great thing about a literary festival from a reader's perspective is that you can go there to hear somebody you've heard of and discover 10 other people you haven't heard of. And that's the way they should work. It shouldn't be an enormous celebrity fest. It should have a nice balance of the people you know and the people that you might want to know. Unfortunately, as it stands, a lot of the people who don't make a living from writing have to factor in the time spent away from their desk, the expenses they are going to have to shell out to attend a festival, and some just can't afford it. And I feel very sad for these people because we should be supporting them. Mm. It's, you know, I've campaigned for fees for all for literary festivals. It's not really because I want 200 quid. It's because, you know, it matters. It's important to the heart of the festival to have people coming in, people of all kinds. It matters to the readers too. Mm.
Of course, you do lots of things for nothing.
Yes, I do, but I like to have the choice.
Well, and you freely give of your time to charity. So you're a patron of the charities Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders,
yes.
And also Plan UK. Now, you've recently, or you went to Togo and the Congo to report on their work. And
I did.
I just wondered about that trip to Africa and how it affected you and your writing. I know that River Song was a story that came out of that.
Yes, I wrote River Song about the Congo and I wrote Road Song about Togo, and they kind of bookended something which which was an unexpected adventure that had come out of writing, and I had no idea that going to those places would affect me in that way. I wasn't there long enough to dare to write a whole novel about those places, because I think you need intimate knowledge of somewhere to be able to write a novel set there. But certainly it gave me some unexpected and marvellous insights into communities and how they work and people and how much we share with different cultures too, and how resilient people can be under pressure, and how it's still possible to have tremendous joy in your life when you're actually in a country at war with the most dreadful privations. And it made me, you know, it broadened my horizons in a way that I'd never expected.
You talk about different cultures, and of course you are a person of different cultures. Your mother was French, your father English, your book Chocolat, indeed that whole trilogy is French. And you talked about reading aloud when you write. Are you reading in French ever?
Sometimes I read in French. French was my first language, and so during my childhood all the books that I read were in French, and then, you know, I started to read in English later on. The languages have very different musical patterns, different algorithms. I think because I'm a linguist and because I'm also a musician, I'm very aware of the sound and the rhythms of languages. This is why I read aloud. This is why I read aloud when I'm editing. And this is why, to me, the shape of the phrase matters. So I think, you know, coming from that background, it's given me a kind of slightly different perspective on the aesthetic of the phrase as I see it.
And what happens when those phrases, when your words are then translated into film and are actually alive but being said by other people?
Oh, well, that's a different animal. I think with a film, the medium is so different, and it's quite hard to reconcile the book with the film. I mean, if I look at Chocolat, I can recognise my characters more or less. I can recognise parts of the story. But to me, the film has a completely different identity. And I like it, and I'm very pleased that it was made, and I really enjoyed the process, which is unusual, I think, for a writer. But I don't identify with it as a creator, really. It is somebody else's vision of what I did. And that's fine, because actually every single reader, when they pick up a copy of the book, will visualise things in a different way to the way I did. And will see things as being important that they have put in there, as opposed to things that I put in there. And that's okay, because everybody claims their part of a book as soon as it's out in the wild. That's their prerogative.
You talked earlier about the interconnectedness of things and how your work will come together as a big jigsaw that finally makes sense. And I wondered if the fictional village of Mulberry would be at the centre of that, because it does pop up in so many of your works.
It does pop up quite a lot. I have not yet managed to take Vianne Rocher there, but she might at some point end up there. It's a strange place because it's partly, I think, the village that I live in, Armonbury, in a slightly different incarnation. I didn't want to write about a real place, partly because I wanted to take liberties with the geography of it and move things around, and for people not to go looking for the real whatever it was. But it's actually acquired an identity of its own, and I half expect sometimes for it to pop up like Brigadoon and just appear ready-made somewhere in North Yorkshire.
Another big theme in your work is food, of course, and you've written three cookbooks. And I wondered if it was ever thus, because you're synesthetic.
Yes. It took me a long time to understand that this was actually a condition and not something that I was just, you know, making up or that other people didn't share. Yes, I smell colours, which sounds very odd, but I do. And I have physical sensations which are triggered by colours and lights, particularly. And so in bright lights, colours will have scents. Most of them are quite pleasant. At the moment, oilseed rape smells of fish rather unpleasantly. And so now's a bad time for my synesthesia. But, you know, most of the time, it's a strange, natural thing that I can't imagine being without.
And how does that feed into your cooking and your writing of cookbooks?
Well, I tend to write a lot in colour and light, and also in scent and taste. I'm not entirely sure of the difference between scent and taste. This may be a synesthesia thing as well. Very often I say something tastes of something when I mean it smells of something. But yes, those things are very foremost in my perception of things, but also in the way that I write. And of course, Blue-Eyed Boy was all about synesthesia.
In your partnership with your husband, who cooks?
I cook mostly. Although Kevin is actually a better cook in that he has an O-level in cookery and I have none. But his idea of cooking mostly is putting a pizza into the oven. Although he could cook if he wanted to. I know he could.
There's a lovely story about how you met.
Yes, we met on a desk In those days, they didn't have social media and they didn't have internet chat rooms. But we met via graffiti on a desk. Song lyric graffiti on my desk as I sat there in English that kept sort of getting longer and longer. And so I started answering it and we found that we were both into the same kind of music. And when we met, it was just, OK, hello.
That's so lovely. Is he a romantic man?
Yes and no. I think he is deeply romantic in his way, but he doesn't really acknowledge the romantic gesture. He doesn't do Valentine's Day or roses or any of those things. He thinks they're a silly cliche. But yes, he's romantic in this sort of quietly cynical way.
You lost your wedding ring once. How did he react to that?
I did. I lost my wedding ring at a martial arts class. I put it on the radiator and forgot it and it disappeared. And I was gutted because, of course, it's terribly bad luck to lose a wedding ring. It means you're going to lose the marriage. And so Kevin had his melted down and he made it into two wedding rings. And so we're basically wearing his wedding ring that's been split into two. That was, I think, probably the great romantic gesture of his life, because the rest of it is not, you know, it's not much about the gestures.
And yet you write so wonderfully about love. Would you call yourself a romantic?
I am in many ways. I think a bit like Kevin, I am slightly cynical about the expansive gesture, but I am all about the sincerity of romance and the heart of it, yes.
What's next for you?
You know what? I've got all sorts of things going on. I am writing an illustrated fairy book, which is for adults, which is called Honeycomb. I have finished the first draft of it, but I'm now waiting for my illustrator, Charles Vess, who is going to take his time over this as he does all his projects, but it will be lovely. And so my band and I, that I've been with for many, many years, have put some of these stories to music and have made them into songs. And we've put them on the road with a show called Storytime, which we've been performing at various venues around Yorkshire. And if this works out, which it seems to be doing, by the time the book comes out, then we'll be able to put the show properly on the road and do something other at festivals than just go, here's my book, buy it, actually, you know, show them what some of these stories have come into, which is a lot of fun, actually.
Making your own musical.
Sort of, yes.
Fantastic. Joanne Harris, thank you so much for talking to me. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.